The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. From the Harvard Health Letter, antidepressants tied to weight gain. We're learning more about the link between weight gain and several major classes of antidepressants, such as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, like sertraline or Zoloft, and tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline, Elavil. Research has shown that putting on pounds is a possible short-term side effect of the medications, but a study published May 23, 2018, in the BMJ, or British Medical Journal, suggests that antidepressants are also associated with sustained weight gain. Researchers analyzed the health information of more than 300,000 people in the United Kingdom, average age 51, who had their weight and body mass index measured at doctor appointments between 2004 and 2014. About 18% had been prescribed antidepressants. During the study period, people who took antidepressants had a 21% higher risk for a 5% or greater weight gain compared with people who didn't take antidepressants. The risk peaked in the second and third years. There was no evidence of weight gain after 7 years. The study was observational and didn't prove that antidepressants cause weight gain, but researchers hope the findings will encourage people to talk to their doctors about weight gain as a possible side effect of antidepressants and plan for potential and even delayed weight gain if they're using the medications. Also from the Harvard Health Letter, three surprising risks of poor posture. Slouching promotes heartburn, incontinence, and more. America, we have a posture problem. Whether it's the result of sitting at a desk all day, looking down at a smartphone, or lounging on a couch, poor posture is dogging people of all ages, and health experts are worried. It's a common and important health problem among Americans, and it can lead to neck pain, back problems, and other aggravating conditions, says Megan Markowski, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Other posture-related problems. While back and neck conditions top the list of potential posture woes, there are many others, such as poor balance, headaches, and breathing difficulties. Researchers are also looking into whether posture affects mood, sleep, fatigue, and jaw alignment, Markowski says. Three other problems linked to poor posture may surprise you. Number one, incontinence. Poor posture promotes stress incontinence when you leak a little urine if you laugh or cough. Slouching increases abdominal pressure, which puts pressure on the bladder. The position also decreases the ability of the pelvic floor muscles to hold against that pressure, notes Markowski, who specializes in helping people overcome bladder, bowel, and pelvic floor functions. Number two, constipation. Poor posture on a toilet, lunched over or hunched over with your knees lower than your hips, can promote constipation. That position closes the anus somewhat and makes it harder for the abdominal muscles to help move feces out, Markowski says. Constipation is characterized by fewer than 3 bowel movements per week, hard, dry stools, straining to move the bowels, and a sense of incomplete evacuation. 3. Heartburn and slow digestion. Slouched posture after a meal can trigger heartburn caused by acid reflux when stomach acid squirts back up into the esophagus. Slouching puts pressure on the abdomen, which can force stomach acid in the wrong direction, explains Dr. Kyle Staller, a gastroenterologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. And some evidence suggests that transit in the intestine slows down when you slouch. In my opinion, it probably does play a small role. What you can do. Markowski recommends seeing a physical therapist if you suspect you have poor posture that is causing problems for you. The therapist will customize a program of exercises and stretches to improve your core muscle strength and flexibility. The core muscles in the abdomen, pelvic floor, and back support the spine. The goal is a neutral, upright spine position, not flexed too far forward or backward. A neutral spine is also important when it's time to move your bowels. Keep your back straight and lean forward at the hips, keeping your knees higher than your hips. By placing your feet on a footstool, mimics a squatting position, which is best for helping to open the anus so you can pass feces without straining, Markowski says. To reduce the risk of stress incontinence leakage, Markowski recommends strengthening the pelvic floor muscles. We teach people how to control their pelvic muscles when they cough, she says. The proper neutral spine alignment will also help minimize abdominal pressure. Some general posture pointers. To attain the neutral spine position, Markowski advises you to put your shoulders down and back. Pull your head back and engage your core muscles. Bring your belly button in toward your spine as if you're zipping up a snug pair of jeans. This will help to engage the transverse abdominis muscle, which acts like a corset around the spine, Markowski explains. Other tips? Use a low back or lumbar support pillow to remind you to sit upright in a chair and change your position every 30 to 60 minutes. We don't want people in fixed postures for hours at a time, Markowski says. Be vigilant and good posture will contribute to many aspects of good health. And the move of the month, seated knee lift. I'm going to describe this briefly. It builds abdominal strength, and what you do is you sit on a stability ball or a chair with your feet hip-width apart and your hands at your sides. Exhale as you lift your right knee and left hand straight toward the ceiling. Return to the starting position. Repeat 10 times. Repeat the process by lifting with your left knee and right hand. Experimental therapy helping paralyzed patients walk again, by Carolyn Johnson from the Washington Post. Kelly Thomas woke up in a Florida hospital 4 years ago with no recollection of the car accident that had robbed her of her ability to walk. Thomas, an active college student who had barrel raced in rodeos, moved to Kentucky for a year to try out a research study that she hoped would retrain her spinal cord on how to walk. In February, a trainer who had been scooting along the floor at Thomas's feet, helping her move her legs and place her feet as she used a walker, stopped and stood up. "What are you doing?" Thomas asked, alarmed. "You're doing it," the trainer, Rebecca Morton, told her. "You don't need me." Thomas hesitated and then took a step on her own, then another. She froze. "I'm like, that just happened? I've been working so hard for 4 years. I got emotional," Thomas recalled. Thomas, now 23 years old, is one of several people with spinal cord injuries who are standing, taking steps, and, in her case, walking without assistance, thanks to an experimental combination therapy. In a research study at the University of Louisville, Thomas and three others had a device surgically implanted on their spinal cords to stimulate electrical activity, accompanied by months of daily physical therapy. In the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers from the University of Louisville reported that two of the subjects could stand and take limited steps at the end of the study, and two were able to walk independently, Thomas and another patient, Jeff Marquis. A simultaneous case published in Nature Medicine reported that a single patient with a complete spinal cord injury at the Mayo Clinic was also able to take steps and walk with trainer assistance with electrical stimulation and intensive physical therapy. The history of spinal cord injury research is we have 50 years or more of essentially failed trials with no positive findings, said David Darrow, a neurosurgery resident at the University of Minnesota Medical School, who was not involved in either study but has also been implanting a stimulator device in people with spinal cord injuries. This is sort of a new era. Darrow said that there are caveats to the newest studies and a slew of unanswered scientific and medical questions. This is still a tiny number of patients with variable injuries, so it's impossible to know how well the intervention will work in the broader population of the people with spinal cord injuries. There are also plenty of questions about how the technique works, which will be untangled only as a broader community of researchers begins to study the approach in more patients. How should you get rid of pills you don't use? From the Wall Street Journal by Heidi Mitchell. Most of our own medicine cabinets are filled with prescription medications, some benign, some fairly toxic, some quite expensive. Bottles typically state how to properly store these drugs, but they don't specify how to safely dispose of unused or outdated pills. So what's the patient to do with these orange bottles filled with leftover meds? One expert, Karen Bastianelli, associate professor of pharmacy at the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy in Duluth, Minnesota, discusses where these pills can wind up and when flushing them down the toilet is actually an option. The Environmental Protection Agency estimated in 2015 that nursing homes across the country toss out about 740 tons of medications each year. The way they and others have gotten rid of unwanted pills varied since the original Controlled Substances Act didn't address disposal until lawmakers amended it in 2014. Still, rules vary by state and regulations usually don't provide a particular method of destruction. Some states have medical waste providers where they ship the waste to that corporation or nonprofit who destroy them by incineration. Others donate to programs where the drugs get used in a medicine repository for redistribution to the needy, Dr. Bastianelli says. As of mid-2018, 38 states and Guam had passed laws for donation and reuse of medications from pharmacies, charitable clinics, or hospitals. Dr. Bastianelli says there are five ways to get rid of unwanted prescription drugs. The best, she says, is medication take-back events. The Drug Enforcement Administration has run these for 15 years, and this May took back nearly 1 million pounds of drugs during its annual National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. Dr. Bastianelli says her local sanitation department holds these sorts of events quarterly and that they are quite effective. Before turning in the meds, she says, keep them protected from heat and light and out of reach of kids. The professor also suggests looking into police departments and medication disposal boxes that have been popping up at pharmacies across the country in recent years. While drugstores drop boxes tend to be open only during business hours, police departments typically will accept prescription drugs at all hours. These boxes are good because once you put them in, they're irretrievable, like with a postal box, she says. Before dumping, Dr. Bastianelli says to black out your name with a permanent marker, but leave the medical information visible in case the police or drugstore need to identify them. This will ensure your privacy, but let experts know what is in the bottle, she says. A third option is to pick up envelopes at your local pharmacy in which you place the meds and ship them off for incineration. Incineration is better than landfill for the environment, since it makes certain these toxic drugs are not getting into our wastewater, the professor says. She's more concerned about unused lethal prescription drugs getting into the wrong hands. Just tossing unused or unwanted pills into the trash is an easy option, though Dr. Bastianelli has a few tips. We want you to remove the label, add kitty litter or coffee grounds to make it unpalatable, and pour liquid into the container to make it icky. Then seal it up with strong tape and hide it in an opaque container so it's not obvious that there is a vial in there, the professor says. The last option is to flush your meds down the toilet, Dr. Bastianelli says. While this does enter the wastewater system, a study published in the journal Science of Total Environment in 2017 showed that the ecotoxicological risk was negligible. The only things we want people to flush are those very potent meds that could kill a person who has never used a narcotic before with one dose. She says the 15 medications on the drug and on the Food and Drug Administration flush list are mostly opioids and other controlled substances that have caused an unprecedented epidemic in this country. We don't want these getting into the hands of kids, especially just flush them immediately, she says. From the Costco connection, play Misty for me. A humidifier can help combat the problems that come with falls dry air by Debbie Miller. Cooling weather and spending more time indoors can lead to a host of health issues, from dry skin and cracked lips to dry airways that can lead to sinus congestion and other problems. A humidifier may help. Here's the lowdown. Indoor winter air evaporates moisture from the skin, says Tracy Gonzalez, an advanced practiced registered nurse, certified pediatric nurse practitioner, and certified asthma educator, who is a spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Dry air decreases the amount of moisture in the respiratory tract, nose, sinuses, throat, and lungs. Dry airways and mucous membranes are susceptible to nosebleeds and sinus congestion and can't filter dust, allergens, and viruses as well as they should. A humidifier increases indoor humidity to between 30 and 50%. This is the optimum range recommended by health professionals. The moist air can soothe dry skin, sore throats, and irritated airways, relieve eczema, and moisturize dry mucous membranes in the nose, allowing them to do a better job of filtering dust, allergens, and viruses, and help the body defend itself against illness. Moisturized indoor air provides comfort by helping to relieve sore throats, nosebleeds, and sinus congestion, as well as cold and flu symptoms. Additionally, humidifiers may help you sleep better at night by relieving dry cough and irritated airways. Brooklyn, New York, Susan McCoy bought an ultrasonic humidifier last winter. She reports it really made the difference and helped my daughter sleep at night without dry coughing. Also from Costco Connection, brain pain. Migraines affect how the brain processes pain, light, sound, and smell, by Eileen Raymond Rush, who is a health and science writer. Migraines affect 39 million Americans, and about 3 out of 4 people who have the condition are women. The World Health Organization says that 127 million to 300 million people worldwide experience chronic migraine, defined as 15 or more episodes per month over at least 3 months. More than a headache, migraines are an inherited neurological disorder that affects how the brain processes pain, light, sound, and smell. Attacks can last from hours to days, and for some, they are continuous. Symptoms can include visual changes, dizziness or vertigo, numbness, weakness, or difficulty speaking. I tell patients they have a gene that gives them an overly sensitive brain, says Dr. Lawrence Newman, director of the headache division at New York University's Langone Medical Center. People with migraines don't do well with change, whether it's a change in sleep, weather, or hormones. Hormonal changes cause women to have more migraines than men, says Dr. Roderick Spears, a neurologist at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia. Boys outpace girls with migraines until menstruation, when girls begin to have hormonal fluctuations, he says. About two-thirds of women with migraines will get some type of migraine around ovulation or menstruation. Among the medications used for migraines are topiramate, antidepressants, blood pressure medications, and Botox injections. But the most excitement in the migraine world concerns Aimovig, A-I-M-O-V-I-G, the first drugs approved by the Food and Drug Administration to prevent migraine headaches in adults. Aimovig is the first in a new class of drugs that blocks the activity of calcitonin gene-related peptide, a molecule that spikes during migraine attacks. Doctors hope the treatment delivered via monthly self-injections can break the cycle of increasing inflammation and heightened pain sensitivity that contributes to migraine headaches. This approach offers new hope for people whose migraine cannot be treated with existing medicine, says Dr. Stephen Silberstein, director of the Jefferson Headache Center at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals in Philadelphia and lead author of the study. The hidden dangers of protein powders. They may contain added sugar, calories, and even toxic chemicals. And this is from the Harvard Health Letter. Adding protein powder to a glass of milk or a smoothie may seem like a simple way to boost your health. After all, protein is essential for building and maintaining muscle, bone strength, and numerous body functions. And many older adults don't consume enough protein because of a reduced appetite. But be careful. A scoop of chocolate or vanilla protein powder can harbor health risks. I don't recommend using protein powders except in a few instances and only with supervision, says registered dietitian Kathy McManus, director of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. What is protein powder? Protein powders are powdered forms of protein that come from plants such as soybeans, peas, rice, potatoes, or hemp, eggs or milk, casein, which is C-A-S-E-I-N, or whey protein, W-H-E-Y, protein. The powders may include other ingredients, such as added sugars, artificial flavoring, thickeners, vitamins, and minerals. The amount of protein per scoop can vary from from 10 to 30 grams. Supplements used for building muscle contain relatively more protein, and supplements used for weight loss contain relatively less. So what are the risks? Well, there are numerous risks to consider when using a protein powder. And among them, number one, a protein powder is a dietary supplement. The FDA leaves it up to the manufacturer to evaluate the safety and labeling of products, so there's no way to know if a protein powder contains what manufacturers claim. Next, we don't know the long-term effects. There are limited data on the possible side effects of high protein intake from supplements, McManus says. Third, it may cause digestive distress. People with dairy allergies or trouble digesting lactose, milk, sugar can experience gastrointestinal discomfort if they use milk-based protein powder, McManus says. And then four, it may be high in added sugars and calories. Some protein powders have a little added sugar and others have a lot, as much as 23 grams per scoop. Some protein powders wind up turning a glass of milk into a drink with more than 1,200 calories. The risk, weight gain, and an unhealthy spike in blood sugar. The American Heart Association recommends a limit of 24 grams of added sugar per day for women and 36 grams for men. A new risk revealed. Earlier this year, a nonprofit group called the Clean Label Project released a report about toxins in protein powders. Researchers screened 134 products for 130 types of toxins and found that many protein powders contain heavy metals, lead, arsenic, cadmium, and mercury. Bisphenol A, which is BPA, which is used to make plastic, pesticides or other contaminants with links to cancer and other health conditions. Some toxins were present in significant quantities. For example, one protein powder contained 25 times the allowed limit of BPA. How could protein powder contain so many contaminants? The Clean Label Project points to manufacturing processes or the existence of toxins in soil absorbed by plants that are made into protein powders. Not all protein powders that were tested contained elevated levels of toxins, and you can see the results at the Clean Label Project's website, www.cleanlabelproject.org. What you should do. McManus says that in certain cases, chemical-free protein powders may be helpful, but only with medical supervision. Such cases could include difficult eating or an impaired appetite as a result of cancer treatment or frailty from older age, a surgical incision or a pressure wound that is not healing well. Your body needs protein to repair cells and make new ones, and finally, a serious condition requiring additional calories and protein in order for you to get better, such as burns. Otherwise, get protein from whole foods, nuts, seeds, low-fat dairy products such as yogurt, milk, or cheese, legumes, beans and lentils, fish, poultry, eggs, and lean milk. You'll find, McManus says, that there are many ways to get protein without turning to a powder. Daily protein goals. Aim for the recommended dietary allowance for protein intake, 46 grams per day for women and 56 grams for men, for example. An egg for breakfast, 6 grams. 6 ounces of plain Greek yogurt at lunch, 18 grams. A handful of nuts for a snack, 4 to 7 grams. And finally, a cup of milk, 8 grams, and 2 ounces of cooked chicken for dinner, 14 grams. More antidotes for newer blood thinners. New medications add advantages to treatments that help prevent stroke, pulmonary embolism, and deep vein thrombosis. The wait is over for an antidote to stop rare uncontrolled bleeding. Linked to some newer blood thinners. The FDA approved Andexanet Alpha, or Andex XA, in May 2018. It's the first and only antidote to reverse bleeding in people taking Eliquis or Xarelto or Savisa. Another newer blood thinner, Pradaxa, already has an approved antidote called Praxbind. A dose of vitamin K is used to reverse the action of warfarin or Coumadin, a blood thinner used routinely for more than half a century and until recently the only such option for most people. This means that people who need to take blood thinners, also called anticoagulants, now have more options in case of a bleeding emergency, and that's going to make a big difference to some people. Blood thinner basics. Blood thinners are prescribed to people at risk for developing dangerous blood clots. These clots can block the flow of blood when they form in the leg or travel through the blood to lodge in the lung or brain, causing a pulmonary embolism or stroke. Blood thinners prevent clots from forming by blocking the production of certain substances in the blood known as clotting factors. Antidotes. Because both types of blood thinners can cause internal bleeding, it's important to have an antidote given by infusion in a hospital to reverse the bleeding. Newer blood thinner antidotes can cut the risk of death from a brain bleed by half. For some people, the low cost of warfarin makes it appealing to keep taking the drug. It's very inexpensive. It costs a few dollars, but the newer ones cost $5 to $30. But if you're just starting out on a blood thinner and you can afford it, take the more expensive one. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy. Thank you.